All right, welcome everybody. Drew Altman, Molly Brody, and of course, Bob Blendon. I hope you all know that I'm the president of the foundation. I'm also an ex-political scientist who's been very involved in our polling since we started the Modern Day Foundation and did our first poll in 1991. Molly Brody is our polling. She's our senior vice president who directs our polling and survey research program. And Bob is a distinguished professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School. He's looking down because he's always afraid about what I'm going to say. But I'm playing it straight today. A distinguished professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School, and an expert in public opinion and health and bioterrorism and global health and politics and even foundations. I'll bet not many of you know, a few of you know, that he was one of a small group who actually founded the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in the early 70s. And he and I worked there together in an earlier era when I was 10 years old and he was 15 years old. This is approximately our 1 millionth poll in the last year, but this poll is actually a special one because it's part of a long-standing special series that we do with Bob whenever there is an election and a new Congress to take the pulse of the public about the agenda ahead for the new president and the new Congress. And obviously, we felt the big issues for us this time were still health reform, which, as you know, we've been tracking monthly with our tracking polls at the foundation. And also, of course, the emerging debate about balancing the budget and reducing the deficit and the debt. So today, just some broad introductory sort of table setting comments from me, and then Molly and Bob are going to divide up a brief presentation, and then we will talk about whatever you would like to talk about. First of all, there always is some movement in the polls that we do, you know, poll to poll or month to month. For example, in this one, opposition to health reform ticks up. As you've seen, if you've looked at the materials, it's actually at the high point for the last year. We think as the buildup to the repeal vote in the House just captured the public's attention, in some past polls, support ticked up actually to the same level in one of our tracking polls. The point I want to make about that is the bird's eye view that shows these upticks and downticks, if you look, you know, at particular polls or any particular month, it's entirely accurate. When we report those polls, it has some influence on the debate. It's also, in some fundamental sense, as we look overall at our polling, a little bit misleading, because the bigger picture that we see in our polling is one of real, it's a picture of real stability and not change in public opinion on health reform. And what that picture actually shows, it shows a public that is split along conventional partisan and ideological lines. And actually, it's a picture which hasn't changed in quite some time. It's a public which has been split on health reform since before the legislative debate. It was split during the legislative debate. And guess what? It's still split today. And how is it split? You know how. With Republicans not liking this law. They do not like this law very much at all. And their feelings about the law are pretty strong. The Democrats do like the law, and some of them, of course, would like to see it expanded in some significant ways, and independents are right in the middle. And so, you know, it's pretty common to hear people say that this law is an unpopular law. What's actually more accurate to say is that the public is split on the law, and it is a law that does not have bipartisan support. So let me just show you two slides that just sort of illustrate this. The first one just shows you the consistency. So you couldn't have a more consistent picture than this, and Molly will talk about the new data, which you see at the end, which I'm going to leave entirely to Molly and to Bob today, because I'm just setting the table here. And the second slide I want to show you is this partisan divide, which all of our monthly polls have just really echoed. And I don't know that you could have a clearer picture than this. And we just see this and see this and see this again. And actually, if you take a closer look at the independents, who are always interesting in this debate, if you dissect the independents, you can see the basic partisan and ideological divide is actually even more stark, because once you take out the independents who lean towards the Democrats, and then you take out the independents who lean towards the Republicans, there are very few who are left up for grabs, and that's this one, which I want to show you. So if you look up at the top, I'll call them the shadow Democrats, they look sort of like the Democrats. And if you look down at the bottom at the shadow Republicans, they look sort of like the Republicans. And it leaves you just with this smaller group in the middle who here we call the pure independents. It's not a big group. It's not inconsequential in political terms, except they don't all, of course, vote on the basis of health. But it's about 12% of the population. So just to back up and make sort of the first broad point, just as context that I want you to have, if you look month to month, you do see that opinion shifts a little bit, sometimes more than just a little bit, but not a lot. But in the bigger picture, as we've looked at this for quite some time now, it really hasn't changed very much. That leads me to the second broad point I want to make. There is a great deal of talk about messaging. I probably get more questions about messaging than anything to do with polling that I get questions about. You know, the perceived weakness of the pro-health reform message, and was it actually, some people would say, a failed message way back when, the success that the opponents of the law have had in making it a symbol of the anger and frustration that some people in the country have about Washington and how Washington is working, the success of some specific anti-health reform messages like government takeover or even death panels. On the other side of it, other messages, the opportunity the repeal vote in the House may give to Democrats and proponents to renew their message and focus on the very popular benefits of the law. It was actually our polling which first documented the popularity of those benefits. So we will be tracking all of that, and all of that is very real. But given how stable, as I just showed you, public opinion on health reform has been, given even more how closely it tracks with these just underlying partisan ideological divisions in the country and partisan divisions in the country, I would not expect big changes in public opinion from any strategy, certainly a messaging strategy. Those shifts at the margin are certainly possible. 5%, 10%, maybe 15% would be a big shift. And I think what will change things, we'll see in what direction. I'm not predicting for sure what direction, is the actual rollout of the law when this gets real on a bigger scale, and how people feel about it when the benefits of the law are actually in place and they can experience it, they can see what happens with their family members and their friends, and that will be the real test. But of course, that is still some years off. Third broad point, with that in mind, I think there's at least the possibility, coming off an election as we are, in which frustration with how Washington works was such a major factor, that the biggest impact of the repeal vote and then the follow-on effort, which is to come to, quote, defund implementation of the law and aggressive oversight, which is to come, and then the Democratic response to all of that, will not be so much on views on health reform, but maybe even more just on general public, further general public disenchantment with how Washington is working. And so this is the last general chart I want to show you. This is actually from our October tracking poll. And we just asked the American people, what do you think is behind these sharp disagreements you're seeing between Republicans and Democrats on the law? Is it a genuine policy difference or is it just politics? And you can see what they said. This is not what I think. This is what the public said. And so the Republican repeal and defunding attack and the Democratic counterattack, which is to come, could actually exacerbate those general feelings about sort of Washington today. And the reason I think that's highly relevant is it may be why we see the very negative response to the idea of defunding health reform implementation, which we report now in this new poll, which is a timely and interesting new finding, which Molly will discuss. Another point about something different. While the health community, a lot of us in the healthcare community, are very focused on health reform, the emerging debate now about balancing the budget, reducing the deficit and the debt, could have even more profound implications for the big health programs like Medicare and Medicaid, especially the big ideas like premium support or capped allotments for Medicaid or spending targets or triggers like GDP plus 1%, which Henry Aaron at Brookings says would mean a 1/3 reduction in federal health spending over 20 years, so that's a big reduction. So it's worth noting that having alarmed seniors more than a little about Medicare spending reductions to pay for health reform, it'll be difficult to pivot to the need generally to rein in Medicare spending, but certainly to cap Medicare, the Medicare program, particularly when we see that resistance to generally cutting the program, but certainly to major cuts in the program is so strong. And that's the territory that Bob is going to cover this morning. And finally, it was also interesting and maybe surprising that while we have always behaved as if Social Security and Medicare are the two sacrosanct programs and the Medicaid program is a much less popular program except to the people who are on the Medicaid program, the standing of the Medicaid program with the public, while certainly not as high as Social Security and Medicare, is actually very high. And that was something that really jumped out to me in this poll. And support for major cuts in Medicaid in this poll is very weak. And what was interesting to me was it was weak even for Republicans. So those are some broad introductory points just to set up the presentations from Molly and from Bob. And with that, let's turn to the new data from the new poll, and we'll get started with Molly.
Thanks, Drew. Good morning, everyone. Whenever I'm on a panel with Bob and Drew, I know that it is my job to set the record straight in terms of the logistics of the poll. So I'm going to start with what I always start with. It was a national random sample survey of 1,500 Americans. We did it by landline and cell phone in English and Spanish earlier this month. And if you want any more details, ask me, not Bob or Drew. So I'm going to start by walking through the first part of the chart pack. You do have it in your packet, so you can follow along there, or you can look up at the screens. Drew's already shown you this chart, and this is our long-term trend on the share of people who have favorable or unfavorable views towards the health reform law. As Drew mentioned, you know, it's a pretty flat picture. There are certainly ticks and ups and downs, and I think that if we did media content analysis and track the number of news stories or the amount of sort of contentious public debate that goes on, you would sort of could map it against the ticks up and down, because that's usually what's driving the anything that we see is conversation that's happening broader nationally. So you can see this particular month, we do see an uptick in unfavorables to 50%. That is largely driven by independents who are more unfavorable, who are more likely to report being unfavorable this month than they were last month. You know, if you had to predict, if you're going to Vegas and predicting what the February numbers would be, you know, I'd follow the probability line is probably going to come back down. But we'll see. We'll see how this conversation continues to go. Now, Drew also made the point about the partisan divide, and he showed you how we have seen this from day one of discussions. In fact, before day one of discussions, if we had taken a different trend question that we had prior to the elections even, you saw the same level of divide. The Democrats were always interested in this law. The Republicans were never interested in it. The independents were always divided. Here is this month's data on favorables and unfavorables by party identification. The Democrats, you know, mostly in blue, have very favorable or at least somewhat favorable views about the law. The Republicans, mostly at the bottom there in orange, have unfavorable views, and the independents are more split, as Drew highlighted before. Now, this next chart, whenever we were looking at this chart pack, I kept thinking we had two charts in there that were the same. And you probably think, oh, I just showed, you know, we just looked at that one. And it looks like an identical pattern. But instead of asking about favorable and unfavorable, we're asking people about what should happen next. And this is the question about whether you'd like to see the law expanded kept about the same, repeal and replaced with a Republican alternative, or repealed and not replaced. And again, it is virtually the same pattern as the unfavorables that you saw before. So Democrats want to expand it, keep it as is. Republicans want to repeal and replace it, or just repeal it. Independents are more divided. And so again, these deep partisan divides on opinion on this law are persistent in sort of lots of different ways you ask about the question. Now, what's particularly interesting, and Drew noted it in his introductory comments, is that, you know, we know the vote in the House on repeal has already happened. So the question is, what happens next? And we've all heard a lot about some of the opponents' plans and approaches that they might want to take up to further slow or stop the implementation of the law using defunding techniques or other sort of techniques. And so we decided to ask the public, what do they think of these things? And you can see here that 62% disapprove of the idea of defunding the law as a way to stop some or all of healthcare reform from being implemented. And that's interesting because it's the first time we've seen sort of a big shift in where the majority lies. And that shift is really coming from the independents. And so I want to take a second to look at this table. And it shows different groups and how they feel about this approach of defunding any part, some or part of the law. You can see that, you know, Republicans, a majority approve of it, but 4 in 10 of them disapprove of it. But what's really interesting is to focus on the next line, the independents. So while about a third of them think that this is an okay way to do politics and policymaking, 62% disagree. And Democrats, you see, again, their disapproval of this kind of approach. I think what's also important to keep in mind is what you see in those next set of rows. Those with the unfavorable view of the law, you still see that 41% think that this approach of defunding parts or all of the law is a bad way to go. And the same thing with those who favor repeal, about 4 in 10 disapprove of it. So certainly we know from lots of our surveys and everybody else's surveys these days that the public is really fed up with the contentious political environment that's happening, and they want government to function. You know, you hear that, you know, loud and clear in every survey. And so, you know, Drew sort of hypothesized this, you know, I'll hypothesize that what these people may be saying as they shift their opinion, they're unfavorable about the law, they want to see repeal, but they're not interested in defunding. They may simply be saying that defunding a law is not the way the government should work. That doesn't seem like good government to me. And we'll certainly be continuing to follow up on this and getting a better sense of why people are saying that in our future surveys. But it's certainly something to pay attention to as we enter into this next phase of public discourse. So, in addition, the survey showed some of the other arguments that opponents have been making about the law that they do resonate with the public. So, in this case, we asked about the views of government involvement. And you can see in the very top row that 54% of Americans do believe that the law is going to lead to too much government involvement. But a third say it's about right, and 1 in 10 say there's not enough. And again, you see our very familiar partisan divides. The Democrats think that there's the right amount of government involvement. The Republicans really think there's too much government involvement. And the independents are slightly more divided. And another criticism that has been waged lately, and you can see here resonating with the public, 60% of Americans now believe that the law will increase the federal budget deficit. Now, this is certainly up substantially from the last time we had asked the question, when it was about 45%. We asked that in April. Now, certainly you're all aware that the conversation in Washington has shifted pretty dramatically with respect to the conversations about the budget deficit. And certainly there's been a lot more focus on it and a lot more rhetoric about the role of health reform in that. So I'm not at all surprised to see that change. Now, Drew also alluded to this when he opened up the comments. We have always seen this sort of divided public in whenever we ask about a nebulous question about the healthcare law. So this big law, you get, you know, about half favorable, half unfavorable, virtually no matter how you ask about it. But what we've always seen also is that many, many, many of the individual provisions that are included in the law are quite popular and quite popular even across partisans. So this particular list is a list of some of the things that are scheduled to be implemented this year. And I will note that we certainly didn't ask people about a medical loss ratio. We asked it in much more layman's terms, and you can see the actual question wording in your packet. But when we asked about these concepts in terms that we think most Americans can understand, you can see that many of them are extremely popular. You know, closing the Medicare donut hole, the voluntary long-term care insurance program, making sure that that companies don't spend too little money on healthcare services versus the profit, the medical loss ratio. These are all things that large majorities liked. And not only that, but when we look at it by party identification, we see large majorities of Republicans, Democrats, and independents liking them. So we've had many, many lists like this. We can show you lots of different of the individual provisions. But for the most part, most of the things that are being offered by the law, certainly all the benefits of the law, are extremely popular, and many of them popular in a bipartisan arena. Now, even when we asked about some of the things that are coming further down the pike in 2014, you can see here that the coverage expansions are very popular as well. And again, that's popular in a bipartisan way, that even the subsidies for low and moderate income Americans, 93% of Democrats like it, 79% of independents like it, 64% of Republicans like it. Now, not surprising, you've heard a lot about this, the individual mandate remains the one provision that has sort of been universally getting panned by the public. They don't like the idea that government tells them that they might have to buy something. But even in this case, I want to raise the importance of messaging and framing. So when we follow up with people and we say, we give them some of the information that either an opponent or a proponent will say about an individual mandate, you can see that the opinion's somewhat malleable. So I'm going to start on sort of the right-hand side of this chart. We start with 76% who say that they're unfavorable about this idea of an individual mandate. If we then give them the argument, well, what if you heard that insurance companies would still be allowed to deny coverage to people who are sick, would you still be unfavorable? And you can see at the end of the day, now just 47% are unfavorable. So we can really move opinion just by giving a little bit more information. Similarly, on the other side, when we take the small group of people who start out favorable and we give them some of the information that the opponents would say about the law, that it might require some people to buy health insurance that they find too expensive or didn't want, then even those people who start out favorably can move away from the law. So the point being that the messaging and the information that surrounds these particular conversations does matter in terms of where people are going to ultimately come out on these things. So it's just sort of a caveat that when you look at any particular finding, you have to think about it in context to how much information somebody has at that point in time about that particular policy provision. And lastly, before I turn it over to Bob to talk about the budget deficit and some other topics on the news, I want to take this issue of the individual mandate one step further. And we asked people about the state lawsuits that are challenging the legality of the individual mandate. And what we found is that Americans have very mixed reasons or beliefs about the motivations of those states and those state officials. So about a third actually believe that the officials who are taking these legal challenges are doing so because they truly believe there's a constitutional issue at stake, that they believe that there's a legal issue at stake. So they're sort of doing it for constitutional questions. About a third believe it's just politics and they're just trying to get the law stopped. And what's interesting is another 2 in 10 think that the officials are doing it because they think that this law is bad for the country and it's their best bet at getting at it, even though they don't actually think that there's a constitutional issue there. So, and again, just to point out, you see that same partisan divide in this question that we've seen all along. So certainly, you know, the outcome of the lawsuits is going to be important. It's probably in many ways more important in terms of the individual mandate than what the public thinks about an individual mandate right now. But you can certainly see that the public at least has some question about the motivations behind those lawsuits. And with that, I will pass it off to Bob.
Hi, Bob London. The debate, and Drew introduced this in town, is about the change. So let me just tie a little framework to the slides we're about to show. The economy was the box that people checked most frequently in the recent election. The thing that's important is it's not like an abstract weather forecast. It is what caused the economy. And for the majority party in the House now, it was excessive government spending and the deficit. For on the Democratic side, it was not the deficit or excessive government spending. It was we had to do a number of things to get the economy revved up. So the central issue about whether or not spending and the deficit was important to the economy or not was the central issue, actually, between voters for that. If I checked the Republican box, I believed it's not that they thought the economy was worse than the other party, it's what they wanted to do about it. And so what I'm going to show in a second relating to the other things we presented is that when you talk about some issues in the context of the deficit and government spending, the picture could be somewhat different. So first is how concerned you are about the deficit. And if I'm a Democrat, I send the signal all through this poll, be very careful about what you're talking about because things that I think are important are going to disappear. If I'm a Republican, I also check a box, which is I really want to reduce government spending. And so every time you mention anything that's tied to reducing government spending, I say yes. And of independents who would have voted or here, they tend to be more on the concern for the deficit spending side for that. So the question is not do you act quickly or not, it's as if it's do I slow down at a traffic light or not. It is important to understand that Democrats, when they voted, didn't think the economy was in trouble by the instant government spending, and Republicans did. So now you're asking them, should we wait till the economy gets better? Well, it's not the problem. Of course we should wait till the economy gets better to try to deal with it. If I think it's the problem, the reason why the economy, the unemployment is high, is because of government spending, then I can't wait. So what you see here is a very important partisan division with more people on the side of saying we have to take actions. But it's a very Republicans with independents in the middle, and that's where you have seen the shift, is independents have started to lean more about concerns about spending and deficits than they would have another time. So the so what do we do about the deficit? And again, though people may not be informed about details, on one side, Democrats have the gist of it that they don't want to see it all come out of spending cuts. And Republicans absolutely have no intention of being in a room where the word taxes appears. For that, and any way you want to ask this for that, and independents are clearly at this moment, I don't want to be in a room that has taxes in it. And then there's a mix about what you do, tax cut spending. The reason it's very important to understand the partisan difference is that though in polls people call for bipartisanship and in their hearts they believe it, when it comes down to do I want to solve this problem with taxes or not, they may be a lot less bipartisan than you think they are. That is, I don't want my representative to raise my taxes. Now, be bipartisan. For that, I don't want to cut programs I really like and be bipartisan. So I think that's the dilemma here is people feel strongly about this. And Drew emphasized messaging, and we're about to enter into a period where how things are framed are going to be extraordinary. So it's pretty simple. There are a group of programs that we absolutely love, and let's say they're over 50%, and we don't want them touched. So that's Social Security, public education, and Medicare. Medicaid is right on the split level, but surely much more popular. We were listening to the radio with one of the prominent congressmen today talking about ending nation building. That's under the foreign aid category, if you can see that. We have to reevaluate, he was saying, nation building. So I guess somebody saw this before we released it. So you can see this, but what I want to make just 2 points about framing. So Molly showed you a slide which absolutely said that people don't want you to deliberately defund this bill. But then I look at how many people would be opposed to reducing some spending under the new bill for the uninsured. Wow, different discussion. So if I say, you're deliberately defunding this, I don't like you. If I say, times are tough and we have to reduce spending for some areas. But let me deal with the most significant issue, and Drew wrote about this and we've done a lot of presentations on this. In an area like Medicare and Medicaid, what is a minor reduction? So a program at a steady state that grows 12% a year, if I cut it back to 4, is that a major reduction or a minor reduction? That's actually what the battle's going to be about. Nobody's going to announce that Medicaid will be half its size of what it was before. I'm sorry, that's not the press release you're going to see. They're going to slow the growth. And for those of you who are journalism, if that is a really major cut, if you really portray that, that really is going to come right back in that slide. You're doing the wrong thing. If you're just going to portray it as, well, it used to go at 8%, but now it's a 6%, that's just a minor reduction. People will go along with it. So the frames about the debate, about extended cuts, and that's really true in healthcare, where the steady state always is double digit. So that's really very hard to understand. And for people you surveyed, they don't get that. A steady state is what I spent last year. A steady state isn't that, well, that's what medical costs go up, and the question is whether or not go back. So this is going to be the crucial debate. And if you look at Molly's slide and you look at this slide, I don't believe a lot of people who want to reduce spending for the new bill are going to talk about deliberately defunding anymore. I think they're going to go to this slide and say, well, we've got to face the deficit. Some things have to be reduced. And they're going to discuss reductions, but no more deliberate defunding for just Molly showing here. It's not a place to go. And so the other debate we're going to have, and just so sometimes, you know, guns and butter are really a debate in real life. One party doesn't really want to touch a lot of defense. And the other party thinks if times are tough and things have to be, you know, shrunken a little, that's where you go. So we are going to see a debate. Is it healthcare? Is it defense? That and there is a split between where people would go on that. The issue of going after Medicare for the deficit is, I think, in our view, still remains more of a third rail than many people would like to. So there are people saying courageously we have to do that. People don't see Medicare as a deficit, and Drew and Molly have shown for years, if you switch the frame to saving the program, which is a whole different discussion, you have a willingness to change things. But if we're talking about just paying down a deficit, there's not a lot of support in that frame to do that. Why it's seen as an incredibly very important program for lots of people, and Medicaid, nowhere near as popular, has a very broad constituency. It's a lot wider, and so people are not prepared to go fully in that rate. The anxiety about the future of Medicare does exist, though. So there's a separate debate, which is not likely to do well wrapped around the deficit, about how you keep the program financially stable. But it won't do well around the deficit. We have pointed this out for a long time. There is a gap between the expert community, what you often call opinion leaders, and average people about why Medicare is in financial trouble. And we've shown this before, but there are a couple interesting things. Years ago, physicians were up closer to a problem. And so they've made an incredible impact of convincing people it's not us. So you have drug companies, you've got insurance companies, and hospitals in the middle. The one thing, and we have done this many times, in a world of experts, getting too much care is a real problem. In a world of average people, that's not what they see the problem as. Very few say Medicare is going bankrupt because we all get too much money, too many care, too many tests. They just don't see it. So it's not very high. The technology has risen up, which is where the expert community is, but it's not necessarily the top of the issue here. So the dilemma on cost is there are some perceptual differences about why we're at this problem that's there. Point that needs to be made, and again, it has to do a bit with messaging. People are more concerned about their own costs than they are of the nation or the employers. So bending curves has a somewhat different view than if you're talking about your own insurance premiums. And so again, that's where framing is very important. Slowing national spending actually involves slowing your spending. I know it's hard to realize, but it is. But if you're up in the stratosphere, you lose a lot of people. Where if you're down to how we're going to deal with your premiums, which is what people are now talking about the new bill. Suddenly the new bill is raising everybody's premiums. Last year, it was bending the national spending curve. It's actually, from our polling, being around people's own premiums, their employer premiums, are still dominant. So this is it. But the one point I just want to make from this is I think you're going to see a shift from a complete assault on the bill alone to really shifting to discussions of reducing funding of components around a debate about deficit and spending. Not a debate, because as Molly showed, these are incredibly popular options. Why do you want to spend your days assaulting them? Why not say, these are wonderful things to do, we just can't afford them? And so I think that's where it is. And for those who are on the other side, they have to get back. So in people's minds, these are real live important things in their lives. They're not, should we take $80 billion out or $100 billion? Well, I think 80 is a compromise. Well, what does 80 mean on terms of Molly's slides? So I think that's from the deficit side where we're likely to go.
Great, assuming they read the poll. I just do want to underscore Bob's point about the importance of framing and the burden on the media and on journalists in the debates that are to come. What's a big cut? What's just reducing a rate? What's a decent health reform idea? What's a pinprick that won't have much impact on coverage or costs? This is a real challenge for all of us who are in the, not just journalists, all of us who are in the explaining business over the next year or two. So we would be really happy to take your questions and just the usual for us and for everyone and for the cameras, you know, who you are and where you're from. Sure, there are questions. Julie was jumping to ask a question.
Well, because this sort of follows on what you were just saying about being in the explaining business. Going back to sort of the early findings about the public being kind of two minds about this law, love the early deliverables mm-hmm. kind of mixed on the law overall. Mm-hmm. Are you asking again what it is that the public thinks it knows about what's in this law? Because it does make me wonder, looking at that last slide, about what the public knows about why Medicare costs are going up. Does the public have any further understanding of what this law does? Because I'm now starting to get the questions about, you know, what's this 3.5% tax on real estate transactions? That seems to be the new viral discussion that's going around.
Yes, in fact, if you're patient to wait about a week, Bianca, we will have our latest update of public knowledge of some of the key provisions of the law. And you're exactly right. I mean, they just don't know what's really in it or what isn't in it in many, many cases. And, the example we've used most often is around the death panels. You know, we describe them as allowing the government to make decisions about end-of-life care, and we still see over half of the public who believes that that is part of the law, and or either believes it's part of the law or isn't sure whether it's in the law or not. About 3 in 10 still believe it's actually part of the law, so we can show a lot of that.
Can you give us a feel for whether it's getting any better as time goes by?
No. there are some things, I mean, some things have certainly permeated people's thinking. So they understand for the most part that if you're 26 and older, you can stay on your parents' plan. So a lot of the, so some of the nicer parts of the law, some of the real benefits that people like have sort of permeated. A lot of the benefits that are a little bit more specific, like the preventative services under Medicare, hasn't permeated yet at all. And a lot of the negative things that are either true or not true are believed to be in there. So since there is so much fear and uncertainty about what's in the law, people are more apt to believe that there's bad stuff in it than necessarily the good stuff that's in it. So if a bad thing or in some people's mind a bad thing is really in it, like a tax or premium increase, then people are more likely to get that right. But I don't think it's because they really understand it's in there. It's just because they're likely to believe that a law would do something like that. But then the death panels, I'm sorry, the government panel that restricts end-of-life care, and some of the other things like that are less likely to be believed.
So, Julie, we tracked at least three things. One is their general perception of their own level of confusion, which for some reason has gotten a little better. Secondly, their knowledge of specific provisions, which Mala just spoke to. And we're starting to track their reports of their experience as provisions are out there, which is confusing because statistically, it's just statistically shouldn't what they're reporting shouldn't be. But we've experienced that before in polling. I mean, my own somewhat cynical theory is that knowledge isn't going to change that profoundly until the stuff is actually out there and they're experiencing it. And the way to think about that, too, is not just the individuals who actually get the benefit, but their family members and their friends. That's how people experience a law, not just themselves. But you see your kids have something, or your brother does, or your best friend does. And then if you do that multiplication, it's a lot of people. But that's years away, as you know. I can't see because of the lights very well. Tiff, are you doing the? Yeah, go ahead, because I can't. I'm blinded.
Dick Miller, independent fiscal economist. I know the limitations of your sample size and everything, but is there anything you can tell us about regional differences in this perception of the law?
You know, what's been interesting about this debate is that we've seen very few regional differences. You know, again, the partisan differences and some of the other divides are just so much more dramatic than anything that we've seen regionally. So it doesn't seem to be a case of whether you happen to be in certain types of areas or not. It's more of a case of what is the dominant political ideology of your area.
So, Olivia Banyan with a company called Hobart Innovations in New Jersey. We conduct research among decision makers who influence healthcare and design benefit systems and so forth. But one of my questions was around whether or not you analyze the data by those who take advantage of a public benefit, either currently or historically, or by their utilization of healthcare services.
So we have looked. Some of the things that we look regularly at are those who have poor or fair health or chronic conditions such that we know that they're more likely to have used the healthcare system. And they generally express more worries and concerns and are generally more favorable about the various provisions and about the law in general. I'm sorry, that was your utilization. What was the other piece of it?
Whether we look at people who are on Medicare.
Oh, right. So we've looked extensively at the views of people who are on Medicare. And seniors have a very sort of interesting trajectory in this whole debate. There is sort of a conventional wisdom out there that seniors are more negative about the law than non-seniors, which isn't really true. They're just as divided as the rest of the public. They're a little bit more likely to be negative, but they, like everyone else, are not thinking about this as one monolithic group. Seniors who are Republicans, surprising, don't like it, and seniors who are Democrats or independent-leaning Democrats like it. They also have been quite concerned about what the law will do to Medicare, but in many cases, again, like the benefits that it's providing. So we have, in some previous surveys, we have an awful lot of work and looking at that and looking at their specific provisions. In this case, we definitely see that seniors are just as favorable about those provisions that affect Medicare as the rest of the public is. Sorry.
Hi, Marilyn Serafini with Kaiser Health News. On that note, Molly, the question in the list of early deliverables that remain popular, there are two Medicare provisions, one of which I'm wondering whether you're surprised that this is so popular. It's reducing the payments to the Medicare Advantage programs. And I'm wondering if you have an age breakdown for that question. Do seniors really like that?
Interesting enough, in the findings document that you also have in your packet, we actually have that table. And seniors age 65 and above, it's still 50% who are favorable towards that provision. So it's a little bit less than the public as a whole, but it's still half of seniors. And again, this reflects the non-monolithic viewpoints of seniors. So I think seniors who are in Medicare Advantage plans are not, you know, happy with those kind of provisions, but seniors who aren't don't really aren't affected by them and don't realize that it's affecting sort of their fellow seniors. So they are much more favorable towards it.
Did you have another provision, Marilyn, you want to ask about? No. Okay.
You know, that again, we have 58% of seniors who are favorable towards that. And again, I think it's the case where a lot of seniors don't think they are the higher income seniors that the premiums would be increased for. And you know, the things that we generally see, and it's this question about the, it affects a lot the deficit related provisions that Medicare, that they talk about with related to Medicare, that seniors are kind of the happiest, or let's see, the most favorable in terms of any age group in terms of raising ages of of eligibility, because they know they're already on the program. And it's the 50 to 64 year olds who are the least happy about it. So I do think that in some of these cases, the seniors don't think necessarily it's going to affect them. So they see it as a way to bring in money. And on the other side, you know, let's be honest, with any more information, they may change their viewpoint, like we saw with individual mandate. But these ideas as standalone concepts seem to be reasonably appealing to at least a big chunk of seniors.
So you think the perception may change over time as seniors start to feel the impact?
It certainly could, and it depends on how many seniors are actually impacted by those provisions. As Drew said, it's not just whether you yourself have to pay the premium increase, but whether friends and family do. And I think that in these cases, it's, and Tricia would be better at answering the question, the share of seniors who would actually be impacted by the increase in premiums, and whether that would really shift seniors' views or not. Again, if we broke these down by high-income seniors and low-income seniors, I'm assuming we'll get slightly different answers the way we do when we look at them from Republicans, Democrats, and Independents.
Richard Green, American Dental Association. Anticipating the eye roll at the mention of the Rodney Dangerfields of healthcare, I didn't see the D word anywhere in your work there. And so, recognizing that you probably don't have new empirical information, can I get your impressions of whether and where dentistry fits into all of this? That's one thing. And the other is that might you consider including it in future tracking?
Well, I love my dentist, but maybe Bob, I don't know if anyone has.
So there's no way from evidence you can say anything about it.
Hello, Jim McLean with the Kansas Health Institute, KHI News Service, and Kansas Public Radio.
Hey.
Just happened to be here.
Happy to have you.
When you take the whole picture, though, and you look at all the moving parts, is it a correct conclusion to say that the strategy of simply defending the law as it is and kind of waiting until the elements and the benefits kick in and public opinion changes, even at the margins, is that a winning strategy? Or given that and what people expect of their government to work, the deficit concerns and everything else, does it suggest that one way or another they have to come in and tweak the law, improve it, change it in some way to make people feel like they've actually addressed the issue in some respect?
That's an interesting question. We can go down the row here. On that one.
Let me take the longer term view here. The issue is actually extremely polarized. That is, the core Democrats who make up the center of that party really like this bill, and they're not going to go quietly in the night. And core Republicans really dislike this bill. And the word really understates the feeling. So what's going to happen is the messaging is a modest impact on independence. The question is, 4 years from now when the bill is implemented, who's going to control the presidency and the Congress? So I believe if you woke up in 2012 and every body of government was headed by Republicans, there would be a very different bill. It would be done in about 24 hours. I believe if the three bodies of Congress are all Democrats, this bill will be implemented with small changes. So the question is, what happens in 2012 if they're really split? And that's when whoever is there has to walk around the block and say, we're polarized, we can't get anything implemented here, can we reach some agreement? But at the moment, I don't believe the leaders of either party are prepared to come to that peace agreement. I think they could have the whole thing in 2012. And the 212 vision of healthcare is so different between the two parties, between what the president and a Republican presidential candidate would have. I think there's not a middle ground until that election is resolved.
The one thing I would say, I think, that you need to keep in mind from the context perspective is sort of something I think Bob said at the beginning, which is the American public wants the economy and jobs to be dealt with. And so to the extent that they keep talking and keep spending time on healthcare, it might be good for the bases, but it might continue to alienate the folks in the middle who switched so much between 2010 and between 2008 and 2010. Because those folks really, 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 as much as they care, you know, about healthcare on the margin, they really want the economy and jobs to be dealt with. And so I do think that there's a balancing act that legislators have to walk and make sure. I mean, you see it in a lot of the, back to the messaging and the language. There was a reason they named the repeal bill the way they named it. And that is because so much of the American public actually wants to start seeing Congress focus on the economy and jobs and make that their primary business, not so much to keep rehashing healthcare. So that's sort of separate from the bases, what the middle really and the swing voters really want to hear about.
Out on the table, there's a column of mine called Repeal, in which I wrote everything Bob just said. So I won't add a I won't add a word to it. Next question.
I'm Peggy Eastman with Oncology Times newspaper. Dr. Brody, your intro was perfect for what I wanted to ask, and that has to do with jobs. Do you think the public has any idea of how the confusion and the repeal of the health reform impinges on jobs? Because employers, particularly small business employers, are not going to hire people for whom they might have to give health insurance when there's so much confusion. And when people don't, when the business community doesn't really understand what they're going to be facing in terms of making new hires.
Yeah, back to the point we were talking about before about, you know, knowledge. I think whenever you think about the American public, you have to remember that they're incredibly busy people trying really hard to do a good job at their own job, take care of their families, put food on the table, and understanding any of the intricacies of how the economy works and how healthcare works, or you know how any of these provisions can work together, is just sort of, it would be asking too much to expect them to understand those kinds of things. So that is one of the reasons why we keep coming back, I think, to the importance of messaging and framing, because they it's feeding into people's underlying fears and concerns that makes it so easy to make people want to see the status quo maintained or no change. And that was one of the huge challenges facing healthcare reform initially, is that it's so easy to scare people away from change. I mean, it's just a much easier proposition than to get support for change because of the uncertainty and because of risk aversion and because just a lack of really understanding the intricate nature of all of these policy decisions and choices.
And also critical to explain and connect with people about how this addresses their everyday problems, which is just paying their bills and dealing with insurance companies. They don't understand bending the curve. We have more questions?
Yeah, Drew Armstrong with Bloomberg News. Seems like we're likely to hear a lot about healthcare during the State of the Union. It's starting to seem like for the next 2 years, just like we have for the last 2 years. I'm wondering at what point does some sort of message fatigue or debate fatigue set in, if it does at all, and how does that affect both how the issue is discussed and perhaps dealt with on the policy side?
Just one view, and then we can get a few. And I think Molly hit this. It'd be advantageous to talk about anything but healthcare. The Democrats are stuck because someone's trying to repeal a bill very quickly. The Republicans will continue to frame this as an economic job issue. And so, in some senses, in order not to have fatigue, if you recall in the middle of the debate, almost half of Americans said, and this was before the bill was enacted, Congress was spending their time on the wrong thing. That was before we even passed the bill. So people just want to see those job numbers change. And so a lot of people criticize the House leadership because they didn't allow any debate on the repeal of the bill. But actually, from a message fatigue point of view, they're on the right side. Vote, get out, to talk about the economy. So there's just a limit of how far we can have. And strategically, the problem, and we can go back and forth, is a bill was passed that has huge proportions that's not implemented for 4 years. If you're in the public opinion polling business, 4 years is a long time for people. And so normally you pass a major piece of legislation and 2 years later they're driving home with it. And so this going on and on over 4 years is going to hurt us not, is just not advantageous one way or the other. So,
And I agree that with every bit of that. I do think the practical immediate dilemma they have is that the stalemate or split that we see in public opinion right now is the result of both sides doing their very best to hammer their messages. So if either side lets up, then you lose ground. And the stalemate or split becomes a decided advantage for one side or the other. So while I think there's a broad understanding in political circles of everything Bob says, I think they also feel kind of stuck. So they'll try to move to the economy and jobs, and maybe healthcare is the new competitiveness program, I don't know. The economy and jobs, but they're kind of trapped in this dance and they don't know how to stop. Next question.
Hi, I'm Jen Habercorn with Politico. I'm wondering, mentioned... Oh, sorry.
There you are.
Over here. I'm wondering, as Republicans start talking about defunding and Democrats ramp up their defense of it, how cemented is public opinion here? Is there room for people to change their minds at this point?
The way I would put it is I think I wouldn't expect any significant change on the fundamentals about the law, but as we've shown you, as a result of messaging and framing, there's room on particulars. Framing can affect, as Bob has discussed, as Molly has discussed, this issue of defunding, so-called defunding implementation. What we've discovered in this poll, which I think is new, is the idea of defunding implementation appears at first blush to be distinctly unpopular with the American people because we suspect it does not look like fair play. It looks like politics as usual in Washington, the kind of politics as usual that the public doesn't like. So we'll see what the impact of that discovery is and whether they adopt other strategies, as Bob hinted they might. Let's take one or at the most two more, and then we're available, as always.
Hi, my name is Tan Shia Terry. I'm from American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network. And I just had a question for you about the Medicaid program. Do you think that the American public has a great sense of what the Medicaid program actually does and if we could actually benefit from better messaging of the program?
Well, the answer to the second part is yes, yes, always yes. But answer to the first part was a real discovery in this poll for me. It was the significant percentage of the American people who said that they had benefited from the program either a lot or somewhat. And of course, it has become quite a large program over the years. And I'm trying to remember the exact number. It was 39%. And what was the other percent, Molly? For Medicaid. Yeah, so what were the numbers?
59.
The two numbers.
So it was how important for you and your family is each of the following government programs, and together you have 59% of the American public saying very or somewhat important.
So this program, you know, if you listen to the poll, look, I was a state human services commissioner. I ran a Medicaid program. I understand the frustration when Medicaid does its job as a counter-cyclical program, but you can't pay for other stuff with the program when it's doing its job. And you hear in recessions just how frustrated and angry people can get with the program. But you also see in a poll like this how, so that's what you get when you listen to policymakers. But how it has become much more a part of the fabric of the country and people's lives than I think we ever suspected. That was almost a revelation in this poll. And that translates into greater resistance to at least big cuts. Bob made the point about small cuts and then what's a small cut? But big cuts, a capped allotment is a big cut. Once it's explained in a debate. That translates into resistance to big cuts. It was really interesting. If you look at the table that's in there, not on little cuts, but on resistance to big cuts, it was the same number as education, if I recall the table correctly. I don't know how all that plays out in a real-world debate. It's really important to state that a lot of the findings that we have here, particularly about budget and deficit reduction, are before the war breaks out. Things change once there's a debate and you see what gets through and what doesn't. But that was a really interesting initial and surprising initial set of findings to me. A very different starting point for Medicaid than you would expect to see if you just picked up the newspaper and, you know, read what you read about the Medicaid debate right now. Okay, one more.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. And my question actually addresses just what you were talking about. What happens when the war breaks out? Insurance premiums are going up. And I think policymakers expect that in 2014, when they're the exchanges, premiums won't go up as much. Are supporters of the bill expecting premiums to go down? And if they don't go down, will there be a big change?
What I'll say about that is I think the way people experience the healthcare system is not the way experts talk about healthcare costs, and they look at their premiums and their deductibles most of all. That's and the drug their drugs because you know they go to CVS and that's what they see, and they are going up. You may or may not have. Why would you have noticed? But I was asked to write a little blurb. We got 200 words about, you know, opportunities for the administration in advance of the State of the Union in health. And one of them that I really flagged was, it wasn't my I thought it was just kind of obvious, but you either get out in front of this problem, these giant premiums around the country, or you own it and run the risk of it being blamed completely unfairly on health reform. So I think it's a very, very big issue. Anyone else want to take that on, or are we? Okay, we thank you very much, and we will be back with more surveys and polls.